This is a milestone in this class. We're actually going to finish a chapter this week. I'm excited. I said, there's no way I can get more than one lesson out of one verse, so we're going to finish chapter 1 of Jonah this week. You know, as I was reading Jonah, I don't know how many of you have great memories long-term memories. My memory grows shorter every year, and it does trouble me that I remember things of my youth more clearly than things of Tuesday. But if you ask me, well, you know, recall something from your early childhood, you know, if you go back and say, when you were 4, tell me something about something that happened to you when you were 4, you know, there's not a lot I can remember when I was 4. I can recall, well, we were living in Creve Coeur, Illinois, and I can remember things. But there's one thing that I remember with great clarity that happened to me when I was 4. I nearly died. And that's one of those experiences that you remember. My church, my father's church, was having a picnic at Pekin Park. And we used to have a lot of picnics over there. We loved Pekin Park because in the middle of Pekin Park, there was this big man-made lagoon. And I don't know how big it was, but in my 4-year-old memory, it was a sea. It was probably not that large, but it was pretty big. And, you know, lagoons, water, that's child magnets. My parents, being neglectful, failed to supervise me. I only say that because my mother's here today. But being the son of neglectful parents, my 6-year-old brother and I found ourselves at the edge of the Pekin Park Lagoon, unsupervised, no CPS in sight. And we amused ourselves. We didn't have a boat to sail in the lagoon, and I don't honestly recall if there was fishing allowed. So we had sticks, and we were beating on the water with sticks. The internet hadn't been invented. We didn't have cable. Sticks and water were pretty much what we had in our family. But at one point, my stick dropped in the water, and as I was bending over to get it, I lost my balance and fell into the lagoon. And I couldn't swim. By the grace of God, as I fell in, I managed to reach back and grab onto this little lip, this little edge around the lagoon and hang on. But I went under. And as I pulled myself back up, because the water was just dark, you could not see below the water. And I remember, as I pulled myself up, I yelled for help. And my brother George, who was only 6, was standing right there just staring at me, just panic-stricken. And I went under again, but I still held on. And when I pulled myself up again, nobody was there. And I yelled for help, and I went under. And I pulled myself up for a third time, and nobody was there. And I yelled for help, and I went under. Only this time as I went under, I lost my grip. And I can remember vividly, at age 4, you have no concept of death or mortality. But I can remember very vividly sliding down, beginning to slide down the side of that lagoon. It was apparently a bowl shape. And I can remember looking up, and the light would only pierce the water by about 2 inches. And I can remember looking up and seeing the light, the water close over me, and the light begin to dim as I slid. And just as the light went out, just as I had slid far enough under that I couldn't see the light, I saw something punch through the water, grab me by the shoulder, and yank me out. It was my dad. And unbeknownst to me, while I was drowning, my brother had managed to attract my father's attention. And even though I couldn't see my dad coming, help was on the way. I was very much in need of that rescue. You know, as we revisit Jonah this week, at the end of chapter 1, we see someone who is slipping beneath the waves. We see someone who is very literally heading to a watery grave of his own design. And we see someone who is in need of rescue, and there's no rescue in sight. As he slips beneath those waves, there is no help in sight. But you know, the good news for Jonah is the same as the good news for me many years ago. He can't see him, but the Father's hand is reaching for him, even as he sinks. And we open with verse 17. It says, and you'll remember from the story, last week they had tossed Jonah overboard, the seas calmed. It says, "Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights." You know, as we begin to look at this next passage, it's important to realize that there is a focus, there is a shift in focus in the passage itself. To this point, in the first 16 chapters of our first 16 verses of Jonah, we've basically seen the focus on Jonah and the crew. We've seen Jonah's disobedience. We've seen Jonah's response. We've seen the crew's response to Jonah. We've seen Jonah's orders to the crew. It's all been about the crew and Jonah. But beginning with verse 17, we see a shift in focus. And verse 17 of chapter 1 provides half of a frame. And the other half of that frame is provided by verse 10 in chapter 2. Those two verses provide the framework for this next passage. And what's the primary function of a frame? When you think about a frame, what's the primary function? It does what? To hold a picture. But what does it do to our vision? It focuses, right. A frame in and of itself, regardless of how ornate it is, a frame's primary purpose is to focus the eye's attention on what's contained within that frame. And that's what these two verses do. Verse 17, beginning with verse 17 in chapter 1, ending with verse 10 in chapter 2. These two verses form a frame to focus our attention on the provision of God. It's all away from Jonah. It's away from the crew. And our focus is brought to bear on the provision of God. And as we look through this passage in the next week or two, or up 2 or 3 weeks, it'll help if you remember to always look at the passage within the context of that frame, because it'll keep your eye off the whale and it'll keep your eye on God. That's what I always try to remember when I hit that phrase, keep your eye off the whale and keep your eye on God. Now, just a little in retrospect, the crew is out of the picture now. Okay, we never see the SS Minnow and its crew again. Come on, what's that from? SS Minnow. Gilligan's Island, thank you so much. We never see Gilligan and the skipper again. But what do you think, when they sailed back into port and told this story, and you know they told this story, but when they got back into port and told the story, if somebody had pulled them aside and said, tell me, what did you learn about God, about this God of Jonah, from your encounter? What are some of the attributes of God? What do you think they could have said? Based on their encounter, what are some of the attributes of God that those sailors, that crew, could have come up with? He's an angry God. He is a powerful God. He's a punishing God. A what? Unforgiving God. And forgiving. Who did he forgive? The sailors. And what did they do? Toss Jonah. Who didn't he forgive? Didn't forgive Jonah. Because remember, last time the sailors saw Jonah, where was he? Heading south. Heading south. What else could they say about God? He is God. He is the God. The supreme God. What else? A wise God? Can't get away. Can't get away from this God. Anything else? Controls. And you know something? When you look at these, you could go on and on. But what two factors would the crew draw their conclusion from? What are the two things that they're looking at to draw their conclusions of God? But what do they draw that from? Circumstances, and what's the other? One is circumstances, and one is a guy. Who's the guy? That's all they have to go on, is circumstances in Jonah. And isn't it interesting, when we look at circumstances, when the world tries to evaluate God, or discover God, and you know that's a big punch mark anymore, is discovering God. When the world tries to discover God, most of the time they will look at circumstances. And circumstances will generally give to an unsaved individual an inappropriate or improper reflection of God, because what do they filter the circumstances through? Their own understanding, a darkened heart. And so they can't rely on circumstances. But looking at the circumstances, they say, this God is angry. How do they know He's an angry God? Well, look at the storm. He's punishing. How do they know He's punishing? Well, He killed Jonah. This is a God who requires human sacrifice. Why? Well, because that's what made Him happy. Jonah died, as far as the sailors were concerned, and this God was happy. If the world just looks at circumstances, they'll never see the true God. They're supposed to be able to look at our lives and see the true God. But they certainly couldn't see that God in Jonah. You know, I wondered if someone were to come up and ask friends of mine and say, list the attributes of God based on Tom Beswick's life. I wonder if they'd say, you know, God's not all that patient. God can be a little flippant. You know, when people start to draw their conclusions of God based on your life, are they getting a clear picture? I had a fourth grade Sunday school teacher, Mrs. Forgy, and between bouts of threatening to tell our parents what we did and complaining that we were the worst class she ever had, she said, I laugh even when I think of Mrs. Forgy, but she used to say, your lives may be the only Bible someone ever lives. And then she'd say, and I'm still going to tell your parents because this is the worst class I've ever had. And I think, oh no, I have a brother 2 years older than me, and that's the worst class you ever had. But it is true. In many respects, you know, the world judges our God through our lives. And it's important that we remember that as we live our lives. Their insight is based on our lives. But you know something? I don't think Jonah was really too concerned at this moment about the crew's theological insights. I don't think Jonah was concerned about what the crew would say about him or God when they got back to port. Jonah was too busy drowning, too busy going under. And you know, the real tragedy is God never demanded that Jonah sacrifice his life for God. Think about that. God never asked Jonah to sacrifice his life for God. God demanded that Jonah sacrifice his life to God. And you know, that's true of us today. God rarely asks anyone to lay down their lives for the cause of Christ. You know, I look around this room today, it may happen. I don't see a whole Gates of Splendor crowd here, but it could happen. But what are the odds? In our country, given our freedoms, given our political climate, what are the odds that God would ever ask us to lay down our lives for Him? But daily, we're commanded to pick up that cross. Daily, we're commanded to sacrifice our lives to God. And let me suggest to you, in some ways, that's a much more difficult task. Because sacrificing your life for God is a one-time decision. You make it, it's done, you don't ever have to make it again. Sacrificing your life to God is a series of decisions. It's a daily decision. It's an hourly decision. Sometimes you're in circumstances where it is a moment-by-moment decision. It is a decision, it is a sacrifice you'll make thousands and thousands of times over the course of your life. But that's the sacrifice God asks for, not for your life. You don't have to sacrifice your lives for God, but to Him. But God had not turned His back on Jonah. And verse 17 says, He prepared a great fish, a really great fish, to swallow him. And just as the storm was specifically prepared by God to stop Jonah in his tracks, the fish was prepared by God to facilitate the next leg of the journey. You know, when you think about one of the main themes of the Bible is God's provision. And if you look at the Bible, it starts with the provision of God, doesn't it? You look at the story of creation. What day was man created? Thank you. Somewhere in the first week. Thank you. Yeah, God, man was created at the end. Why? Because between day one and day six, God was creating what was necessary to provide for man. Yeah? He laid the groundwork. He provided the atmosphere, the water, the food, whatever was necessary to support the life of man, God created first. The Bible is, among other things, an account of God's constant provision. Now, that provision is played out in a number of different scenarios, and certainly not all of them, you know, involve a great fish. Oh, can you think of any other provisions in the Bible that involve fish? Fish, yeah, the feeding of 4,000, feeding of 5,000. Coin in the mouth, which was always my favorite. That was all. I didn't fish much as a kid, but whenever I fished, if I ever caught anything, I always thought it'd be so neat to find something in the fish. Never, well, I did fish guts, but I always thought it'd be neat to find like a coin, anything. Yeah, so there are other instances where God used fish. But while the provisions of God are played out on a number of stages, there are three constants that are always present in every provision. Every time you see God provide in the Bible, and I suggest any time you see God provide in your life, you'll see these three constants. And they reflect the character of God. God's provision is always specific. It is specific to the need. It is always timely, and it is always sufficient. No matter what need God meets in the Bible, it will be met specifically, timely, and sufficiently. That's true in your life. It's true in my life. Think of a time in the Bible where God provided something, and there will always be a spiritual truth that underlies that provision. Think of a time in the Bible where God provided something. Sacrificial lamb. For who? Abraham's sacrificial lamb. In Marah.
Yeah.
But when God provided the sacrificial lamb, what was the specific need Abraham had? He needed the sacrifice. God didn't send water, did he? He didn't give Abraham something to drink. There was a need for a sacrifice, for a perfect sacrifice. When did Abraham need it? Isaac on the altar. You noticed? They didn't pick up the ram going up the hill. They picked the ram up the lamb after the sacrifice of Isaac had almost been made. It was timely. Don't you think Abraham would have liked to pick that up on the way up? Don't you think that would have given him a little safety net to where he said, okay, good, I've got Isaac, but all of a sudden, now I've got this lamb, or this ram. And how was it sufficient? That was the sacrifice that was commanded, wasn't it? Now keep in mind, this was before the law was given. So we did not have those specific, well, it has to be without blemish and without spot, and it has to be the firstborn of the flock. And if, you know, at that point, when Abraham sacrificed lamb, you can't take that over to the law and say, well, goodness, how does that match up to the law? It may not. Law hadn't been given. But it was sufficient because it took the place. And we have the water at Mira. And by the way, what were some of the spiritual applications of that? There was a necessity of faith. What else? Substitution. You know, even there, kind of foreshadows the ultimate substitution. There's different. The provisions of God. Providence of God. There's a lot of spiritual applications. Kari said the water at Mira. What was the need? What was the background for that? Who was this for? It was for who? For Israelites. And why did they need it? They're dying of thirst. There was a very real need. They didn't need food at that point. They weren't crying out for food. They were crying out for water. When was it given? When needed. Nobody died of thirst. They complained because they were getting sick from drinking bitter water. Nobody died of thirst. And was it sufficient? Amazingly, you can't even begin to imagine how much water does it take to quench the thirst of maybe 2 million people plus livestock, the entire nation. What are some spiritual applications? Ooh, no faith. But what are some spiritual applications? What is a foreshadow? God's provision. Living water. Abundance. Reliance. There are all those things. God's provision is always specific. It is always timely. It is always sufficient. And it will always be undergirded by spiritual applications. God doesn't do anything without a spiritual application. Remember, we looked at that when we looked last fall at miracles. God does nothing without a spiritual application because that's what God is all about. God is spirit and truth. If we worship Him, we must worship Him in spirit and in truth. Everything God does has a spiritual application. Okay, moving to Jonah. Think about God's provision of the magnificent guppy for Jonah. It was specific. About 5 seconds after hitting the water, if you could have done a freeze frame and said to Jonah, what do you need? What do you think his answer would have been? Oxygen? But specifically, rescue. Provision. Preservation. Yeah, help. Help. Because that's what was right in front of him. And that was an immediate need. And you know, when need arises in our lives, we see the immediacy. We see whatever impacts us first. That's what we focus on. And that's what Jonah focused on. You know, if God wanted Jonah dead, he didn't have to do anything. Jonah was already taking care of that quite nicely. But Jonah needed preservation. And if you had said to Jonah, what do you need? Believe me, that's all he would have come up with is help. Save me, preserve me, rescue me. But you know, God doesn't just deal on one level. Jonah had other needs. There's more. Jonah needed an education. There were lessons to be learned. God wasn't through with Jonah yet. While Jonah didn't know it, Jonah was still going to Nineveh. God knew it, but Jonah didn't know it. But there were some things Jonah needed to learn before he got to Nineveh. Jonah didn't know it, but he was going to go back to Israel as a prophet. And God needed to teach Jonah some things. Jonah didn't know it, but he had a need for a further education. And in his providence, God determined that the belly of this fish was the perfect classroom in which Jonah was to be instructed. There were no distractions. There was nothing else to occupy Jonah. God had determined that the belly of the fish was the greatest classroom. Same God, same approach to life. We're 2,000 years later, 1,500 years later. We're 2,000, 2,800 years later. We're still dealing with the same God. Let me tell you something. God still puts you and me in the belly of the fish sometimes. God still isolates us in our lives to educate us, to get our attention. The older you get, I think the more you can look back in your life and say, you know, to me that was kind of a belly of the fish time. That was a time when God set me apart, when God dealt with me. Here's the problem. None of us like to be in the belly of the fish. By definition, it's not a fun place to be. It's not a comfortable place to be. But that's where the greatest lessons are learned. You know, I think the first time I can ever recall in my life being spending any time in that environment was my junior year in college. It's one of those years where everything went wrong. My girlfriend dumped me, which is just a testimony to her terrible taste in men. I didn't have enough money to make it through the full year, so I had planned when I would have to drop out. And back when I was in college, you were either in college or in Saigon. It was one of the two. You were going to Vietnam if you weren't in college. they drafted everybody who could walk and wasn't in school. That was a little stressful. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I had toyed with a few things. None of those things had any appeal. I never thought about being a lawyer. Now, if I'd just known I never had to grow up, that would have eliminated a lot of the stress. But I didn't. At the time, I thought I would have to grow up. It was a really tough year for me. And it was a year, though, that I spent feeling isolated. It was an intense year for me. But it was a year where daily I poured myself into the Scriptures. Daily I poured out my heart in prayer. Daily I sought God's will for my life because I had no other choice. And even though school was going on, I had my friends around me, I was alone. I was isolated with God. I spent that year in the belly of the great fish. And you know something? God didn't just drop a new girlfriend into my lap. And He didn't let me win the Reader's Digest sweepstakes. But you know, I met my wife that fall. He had someone for me. And He made me content without the relationship that I had lost. He didn't let me win the Reader's Digest sweepstakes, but He gave me a lousy job. Oh, it was a lousy job, but it was a job that paid just enough to pay for school. And nobody knocked on my door and said, God has a wonderful plan for your life and you are going to be a... But He did open up law school, which was something I had never even remotely considered in my entire life. And looking back on that year, it was an amazing year of lessons learned. It was an unpleasant year. But it was an amazing year. It was a year where God isolated me. Maybe you can look back in your life. And you know something, it's not the last time I visited the belly of the great fish. Except now I recognize it a little faster. Because that's an environment you never forget. I'll bet everyone in this room has spent time in the fish. You might be spending time there today. If you haven't been there lately, you're going to be there. Because God will isolate you at different times in your lives to deal with you. The great comfort is there's a purpose for it. God's sovereign, and it's temporary. You haven't taken up residence. You're just a renter, a temporary renter. So Jonah needed preservation. He needed an education, but wait, as Ron Popeil would say, there's more. This was also... I watch way too much television. Maybe Tom's right. I need to get rid of my television. This is also a form of reproof, of discipline. To this point, really, when Jonah hits the water, what circumstances or what consequences has Jonah suffered for his sin? A little seasickness. Little unpleasant encounter with the crew, but hey, you know, that's not so bad. Yeah, Jonah hasn't really suffered, has he? He's sinned, he's willfully sinned, but he hasn't really hit a problem yet. He hasn't suffered the consequences. And yet the Bible tells us repeatedly that there are definite consequences for our sin. Now, it assures us as Christians that we won't suffer the ultimate consequences, but nevertheless, it does remind us time and time again that there are consequences that follow our sins. You know, Galatians 6, 7, and 8, that familiar passage, it says, don't be deceived. God's not mocked. Whatever you sow, you'll reap. There are consequences to your life, even as a Christian. If you live a life in disobedience to God, there are consequences. If you sow to the flesh, you'll reap to the flesh. If you sow to corruption, you reap corruption. Jonah hadn't reaped anything yet. He needed to reap. The belly of the fish was a time of punishment. It was a time when Jonah would recognize the consequences of his conduct. He's been on a path of his own choosing. God corrects him. He reproves him. He disciplines him. He corrects him to bring him back on a different path. Jonah had all these needs. He needed to be rescued, but he needed an education. He needed discipline because his path needed to be corrected. This belly of the fish was used for, you know, correction, for reproof, for instruction of righteousness. What am I doing? 2 Timothy 3:16. You know, isn't that what the Word of God does? It's profitable for all those things, including correction, instruction, reproof. And what's the end? That the man of God may be thoroughly equipped to all good things? That's what God's doing in the belly of the whale. 2 Timothy 3:16 isn't around yet, but you know something? The God who gave 2 Timothy 3:16 is around. And God never changes. His approach is always the same. He's trying to equip Jonah for every good work. That's amazing. All Jonah would see is, I need to be rescued. God said, there's so much more. That's how it works in your life and my life. When we identify a need, we identify the immediate need. God looks at all the needs. And God moves to meet all the needs, whether we can identify them or not. So it's specific. It's timely. Timing is everything. I don't know how long you can hold your breath. When I was writing this, I tried to hold my breath. And I held my breath. I think the longest I got to was 40 seconds. Now, I think in a life and death situation, I could go 42. But it's not a long time. It's not a long time. And as you go underwater, what happens? The pressure around you increases, doesn't it? And so you actually hold your breath for a lesser amount of time because the water pressure will actually force oxygen out of your lungs. We're talking about a very small window of opportunity with Jonah. A very short window of opportunity. He hit the water. He went in. This isn't SeaWorld. They didn't throw him overboard and Shamu didn't come up and grab him in midair. Jonah hit the water and he went under. He sank. Now, if you were Jonah, when do you think Jonah would have liked God's provision to kick in? Immediately, yeah. I think immediately. I think if he'd even had the choice, he would have said, I've never heard of this Shamu, but that sounds good. If I have to be swallowed by a big fish anyway, let it be in midair. Let the crew and the captain have a real story to tell when they get back to port. And then we threw him overboard and this big fish jumped out and swallowed him. There's a story. Yeah, immediately. Jonah would have asked for immediately, but God allows Jonah to sink. And God allows Jonah to think. I was reading a medical journal this week. It's also known as the Reader's Digest, but I prefer to think of it as a medical journal. And I don't want to brag, but I am a subscriber. You know, it's the American Medical Association. They have a journal, Reader's Digest. I think it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. But according to the Reader's Digest, they had an article on the brain. They always have an article on an organ. Have you noticed that? I think if the body ever ran out of organs, the Reader's Digest would have to cease publication. But they were talking about the brain, and I recalled from an earlier article I read about the thousands and thousands of thoughts that pass through our minds every minute. And so literally thousands pass through our brains every second. There's all these brain waves going on, and impressions are being made, and things are just flicking in and out. Now, we only think of about one thing at a time. And sometimes we just sit there staring off into space and doesn't seem like to think about anything. But we focus on one thing, but there are thousands of thoughts that flash through our eyes. You know, that's why you hear people say, well, you know, when you're about to die, your whole life flashes before your eyes. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Maybe we'll all get there, maybe we won't. But as Jonah sank, what do you think some of the things he was thinking about? Yeah. Oops. You know, maybe a do-over. For you golfers among us, he might have wanted a mulligan. Maybe want to think over that whole throw me over the side of the boat. What else do you think you might have been thinking about?
Maybe he should have obeyed.
Yeah? Maybe obedience wouldn't have been such a bad thing. You know, Nineveh's lovely that time of year. I understand maybe those Assyrians aren't such bad people. Maybe my head won't be on a post. How about that family I left behind not so many days ago? How about my land that I abandoned? How about the gift of life that I so freely threw away just a few seconds ago? You know, I think God often allows time to lapse between the point where we identify a need and He meets that need to give us time to think. If Jonah had been rescued immediately, if the fish had swallowed Jonah immediately, if another ship just happened to be passing, and as Jonah was tossed out of one ship, he landed on the deck of another. If a wave had washed him back onto the deck of that ship, so he said, thank goodness. Where's the time to think? Where's the time to think? God gives us time to think. Because if we have no time to think, we have no time to learn. God gives us time to think about maybe the circumstance, maybe how our conduct contributed to where we are. How did our conduct, what did I do to get myself here? You know, it's not always us, but a lot of times it is. A lot of times the situations that we find ourselves in where we need deliverance are things of our own making. If only. Yeah, what if? What would I do over again? If I get out of this, how am I not going to repeat that same conduct? But to also think on the past faithfulness of God. How's God delivered me in the past? You know what? This isn't the first time I've had trouble. What's God done before? And I can take comfort in that. You know, look around me. There are other people who are in trouble. How have I reacted to those people in the past? And what can I do in the future to alter that conduct? There's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of things that we can think about when we find ourselves in times of need. And God gives us that. Here's the thing. No matter how much time lapses between the need and the provision, it's always the perfect amount of time. In God's providence, it's always the perfect amount of time. And that's really difficult for us to accept. When you identify a need in your life, what's your immediate response? If you can meet that need, you do what? You what?
You
meet it, don't you? I mean, if I was standing up here thinking, man, I am dying of thirst, and there's a drinking fountain, but you know, I bet I could go 2 days. I bet I could go 2 days without drinking. No, if I'm dying of thirst, I'm heading for the drinking fountain. That's a small thing. But you know, that's how we address the needs in our lives. The first thing we look at is what? If I have a need, what's really, let's be honest, because we're in church and God will kill you if you're not. No, that's not true. That's not true, but it's a happy thought. The first time you identify a need, what's the first thing you think? How can what? How can I meet that need? What can I do to address that need? That is always our first thought. It should not be our first thought. Now, there are some mundane things, like, yeah, I'm thirsty, I'll get a drink. But that thought process carries over to every avenue of our lives. Because when we identify a need in any area, the first thing we want to do is, what can I do? And if I can't solve it, who can I find that will solve it for me? What expert can I plug into? Now, God has given us experts. I mean, if you're sick, you know, if you fall down and break your leg, you're not supposed to lay there thinking, how can I, do something about it. Don't just lay there. Can God just reach down and heal it? Yes. Is He going to? Probably not. Probably need to get that doctor. But we always think, first and foremost, is what can I do? And then secondly, who can I find to fix this for me? You know, what we need to do is look first and foremost at what is God's timing in our lives. Is to rely on God. We look for immediate resolution. We look for immediate solutions. And we rarely look beyond the immediate need. Jonah did not look beyond his need for rescue, for preservation, even though he needed an education, even though he needed discipline. And that's us too, because we get so focused on what is that need and how can I meet that need, we don't look further. We don't look further. God sees all the needs. He sees the spiritual application, and He moves in His time, to meet all those needs, spiritual and physical. And the Bible talks constantly about waiting on the Lord. You go through the book of Psalms, constantly the psalmists talk about the joys of waiting on the Lord. You know, in Isaiah, what is it? Isaiah 40, 31, those who wait on the Lord shall rise up with the wings of eagle, they shall run and not be weary. In Romans, Paul talks about the importance of waiting for the glories of eternity. In Romans 8, he talks about waiting for the glories of eternity. We're constantly reminded that we are on God's time. He is not on ours. He is not on ours. And as difficult as it is to wait on God, it's important to realize that God waits on you every day. And God waits on me every day. Yeah, God does have an eternal plan. And that plan is perfect. But it's a little humbling to realize that within the parameters of God's perfect eternal plan, He scheduled downtime to wait on you and to wait on me. And you know how I know he's still waiting? My progressive sanctification isn't done yet. I'm a long way from where I should be. God's waiting. I don't learn spiritual lessons the first go around in my life. A lot of times God has to beat them home 4 or 5 times before I say, okay, I get it. God waits on me. God waits on you. Even though your time and my time is not perfect, God's time is always perfect. God allows Jonah to sink, but not too deep. He allows Jonah to think, but not too long. And he moves to intervene. God always has a provision. That great fish was right in the line of Jonah's descent, but just out of the line of Jonah's vision. That's how God's provision usually works. We can't see it coming till it's right up on top of us. That's why in 2 Corinthians 5:7 it says, we live by faith and not by sight. Because with these eyes, I'm telling you something, we'll virtually never see God's provision until just about the moment it hits us. You know, just I didn't see my dad's hand till just the moment it grabbed me by the shoulder. Didn't mean it wasn't coming, it just meant I couldn't see it. I couldn't see my dad running across the park to the lagoon. I couldn't see him reaching in just as he saw me go under the water. It was happening, I just couldn't see it. We can't see God's provision. But by faith, with these spiritual eyes, we know that that provision is at hand. We live by faith and not by sight. So it's timely and it's specific. And finally, it was sufficient. You know, and if it's difficult to accept timely, it's almost impossible to accept sufficient. The fish was enough. You know, the fish was enough. Do you think if you had asked Jonah, okay, you need to be rescued, so tell me, what mode of rescuing would you like? Would you think he'd say, I'd like to be swallowed by a great fish? No, of course not. Of course not. I mean, this was not a pleasant environment. This wasn't the Ritz. I say that, but I've never stayed in the Ritz. Has anybody ever stayed in the Ritz? Okay, then I will say it. It wasn't the Ritz. And I won't be contradicted. It was a nasty place. You know, I mean, you can imagine. I'm sure it was dark. I don't think those fish come with portals. It was wet, damp. I bet it smelled. I bet it was messy. And even as I was writing down the qualities of that great fish, I thought, this sounds like my freshman dorm room. You know, kind of dark, damp, messy, it smelled all the time. Yeah, I have been in the belly of the fish. But I think Jonah was in a worse situation than I was in. But it would... that's right. The military academy, don't they? Yeah, the military academy. But it was enough. It was enough to accomplish his rescue, his education, and his discipline. It wasn't what he would have chosen, but it's what God chose for him. And we all struggle with the issue of sufficiency. And in our Western culture, where bigger is better and more is to be desired, and where we look out the window, and every time I drive to church up White's Chapel from Colleyville, they're tearing down another perfectly good house to build a huge house. That's a reflection of what we view as sufficient. And even though as Christians we can take a stand and say, no, you know, I'm not tearing down a big house to build a bigger house, and, you know, I'm not worshiping those things. Still, like Tom said, influence is an extremely difficult thing to overcome. And our attitudes toward what is enough are constantly under pressure. They're constantly expanding. What is enough? What is enough? What is sufficient? The problem isn't with the nature and extent of God's provision. The problem is with the nature and extent of our great expectations. Because our expectations often exceed God's definition of sufficiency. Now, let me say it again so you don't misunderstand. I am not saying that our expectations can exceed God's ability. I'm saying that our expectations often exceed what God deems to be sufficient for us. And that's where much discontent arises in the Christian life. It's not because we have not been given what God deems to be sufficient. It's that God has not met our qualifications, has not met our standards of sufficiency. We look around us. Other people have more. Other people have better health. Other people's kids are better. Other people are rising faster in the corporate world. Other people have better relationships. Other people drive nicer cars. I don't ask for that, but I'm down here. I just kind of like something in the middle. It's the nature and extent of our sufficiency. It's important to remember, what does the Bible say about our lives on this temporal planet? On this line of existence? What are we supposed to be? What is sufficient in the eyes of God? You know, in Matthew, chapter 6, verses 25 and 26, to just summarize it, Jesus said basically, if you have enough to eat, you have enough to drink, you have clothes. Hey, that's sufficient. Enough to eat, enough to drink, and you have something to wear. Doesn't that kind of cover us all? In 1 Timothy 6, 7 through 10, the writer said, Paul says, you know, we brought nothing into the world. We're not going to take anything out. If you, again, have food to eat, something to drink, and clothes to wear, that's sufficient. And probably the greatest condemnation or comment was by our Lord in Luke 12:15, where he says, you know, I can just imagine him. When I read this verse, I always pause because it looks like I feel like he's looking at me. He says, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. You know, it's all about the yardstick. What is sufficient? How do we measure the sufficiency of God's provision? I guarantee you, Jonah did not view those accommodations as sufficient. But God has a minimalist view on temporal matters and a maximal view on spiritual matters. Because Paul's right. We brought nothing in, we're taking nothing out. Moths eat, rust corrodes. It's the eternal things. The flesh tells you exactly the opposite. The flesh says, let's take a maximal view on temporal matters. What you can see, what you can touch, what you can taste, what you can feel, the relationship you can experience, that's what's important. And spiritual things, take a minimalist view. Those things will take care of themselves. God says, no. Order your priorities. Order your priorities. 1 Corinthians 2:9 says, you know, eye hasn't seen, ear hasn't heard all the things that God has prepared for those who love Him. Probably the best verse in the Bible that deals with sufficiency is Psalm 37:4, a familiar verse. It says, delight yourself in the Lord, and He will provide the desires of your heart. I hear that verse quoted. Actually, I hear Psalm 37:4b quoted a lot. God will give you the desires of your heart. I've heard that many times channel surfing through these health and wealth gospel presentations. God will give you the desires of your heart. The Bible says so in Psalm 37:4. Don't bother to turn there, but it says God will give you the desires of your heart. And they're absolutely right. If somebody glances at Psalm 37:4, they say, oh yeah, there it is. It says God will give me the desires of my heart. They always skip Psalm 37:4a. Delight yourself in the Lord. Yeah, because if you delight yourself in the Lord, what happens? You know? Yeah. He changes you. His desires become your desires. The nature and extent of His provision becomes the nature and extent of your provision. His definitions become your definitions. If you delight yourself in the Lord. So it's not that God has changed to meet your expectations, but your expectations have changed to match up with God's. That's sufficiency in the kingdom. God will not change to lower Himself to our expectations. The whole function of the Christian walk is for us to change, to reflect the expectations and the will of God. 3 days and three nights in this divine bed and breakfast may not have been what Jonah signed up for, but it's what God said, this is sufficient. And in the center of this frame, God is in focus. You know, with one mighty gulp, Jonah's first leg of the journey comes to a close. You know, as I recall, our timetable that God had established at the beginning of the first chapter said, Jonah, you're going to depart from Israel. Your destination is Nineveh, and you will arrive in Nineveh. And Jonah set up his own timetable and he said, okay, I will depart from Israel, but my destination is Tarshish. And now he's arrived in the belly of a great fish. Jonah has found that there is a real surcharge to pay when you deviate from God's travel plans. And it's not one that Jonah can afford to handle. You know, as we close today and we consider our lives, as we look at your life and I look at mine, it's important to determine whose travel plans are we following? Whose itinerary are we on? Are you choosing your own path? Are you plotting your own route? I mean, admitting that God ultimately is in control and when I die, I have an eternity to look forward to. But right now, I'll kind of handle things. You're deviating from God's itinerary. You might say, well, wait a minute. God's never come to me and said, go to Nineveh. In fact, God's never said much of anything to me about direction. If God has never spoke to you about the direction He wants your life to take, it's because you're not seeking God's direction. And you know, not considering God's will is every bit as much an act of rebellion as knowing God's will and rejecting it. God looks at him the same. You know, Jonah reminds us there's a surcharge. There's a surcharge to pay, and it's not one you care to. Maybe today you're in the belly of the fish. Maybe you have physical needs, health needs. Maybe you have relationship needs. Problem within a relationship, problem because there's a lack of a relationship. Maybe you have employment needs. Whatever those needs are, and you've identified those needs, and you've struggled with those needs, and you say, well, you know, I've had this need for weeks, for months, and I keep talking to God about it, but nothing's happening. He's not providing. I'm telling you, the provision of God has already been established. It's out of your line of vision, but it is in place. And there is a reason why you have not reached that place yet. You're still in the belly of the fish. God's still teaching you. Look to see the spiritual application. You're only there temporarily, but you're there for a reason. Help is on the way. Help has already been established. And God's provision is specific to whatever your need is. It is timely, but it is timely on God's timetable. And it is sufficient. Whatever God has determined needs to be done to meet that need in your life will be done. Because that's who God is. He's a God of discipline, but He's a God of provision. And He's a God of determined grace. Next week, we begin to look at the Psalm of Jonah. A beautiful prayer of praise formulated as Jonah sinks to the bottom of the Mediterranean. Let's close in prayer. Lord God, we thank You that You are a God of provision. We thank You that no matter what our needs are, You have already predetermined to meet those needs. I pray, Lord, that You will give us the eyes of faith to focus on You, to trust You that in Your time, Lord, not in ours, that You will meet our needs. And when those needs are met, Lord, may we accept Your provision as being sufficient. May we not try to impose our definition of sufficiency on You. Lord, may You conform our hearts and our minds to Yours. May Your desires be ours. May Your definitions of things be ours. May we see things as You see them. And in so doing, Lord, may You draw us closer to You every day. And we pray this in Your name. Amen.